tide should fall into the sea and the stars fade all around me. Oh, the time that we have known near, I will sing a hymn to love.
You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. Lights came on, two golden bulbs in the distant corner, straining their filament over the topple and clobber of the heaping things. All the old clothes in their old boxes in a sodden pile. The boxes now damply fallen, decaying, baggy, ancient, melting down from their stacks. How many years, Edna? Our life, Albert. Our life. Our life, our life. She was standing just inside the entrance of her container at the Bristol storage facility. Her eyes searched the shelves for the radio. The strangest wedding present they'd been given two. And who gives radios for weddings anyway? And who gives two? 40 years later, it made a kind of unpleasant sense. The red fingers of her white hand stiff in the cold air, and a napkin from her black pocketbook to brush her nose tucked tightly to her palm, and another folded once in her skirt, just in case, just in case. In the old days I wore gloves, remember, Albert? How many gloves will I find here, like all my old hands, all my old spare hands, if ever there was, my wedding hands, my Bermuda hands, my winter hands, my driving hands, all my old gloves, Albert, but really how close to my hands, the shape of my hands, the skin of my hands, my old hands, Albert, my old spare hands in the boxes here, and your old hats, with the scuff from your head and the sweat of your brow colouring along the brim. Every year a new one from the Bracket hat shop, who had the best felt and used real feathers from Italy. My hands and your head, and that's just what I'll do when I leave after I find the radio. I'll set a pair of gloves inside your hat, and I'll set them both right up on the shelf, and that'll keep me warm at night, Albert, so warm in bed, my gloves inside your hat, laid down like lovers, my hands upon your face. My hands, Albert, your face. Remember, I still go to the Bracket hat shop, but it's a laundry now, and there's no sign of feathers. She took a step forward, then stopped. Her breath dissolved. Was there someone? The sound of feet, or shuffling, of breathing, wheezing air disturbed, or jangling keys under the murmur of a pocket, of a door shut in the distance. Voices. Echoes, hollow, broken glass, a walkie-talkie, a car started, a telephone ringing inside an owl hole in the far-off forest. How late was it, and who could it be? Who could it be, and how late? Especially where she was, out here, where it was nowhere, really. On a little stretch of nowhere beside the lake, against the forest, where no one ever came. Icicles in her heart, scratching out their blades to taste her blood, which had slowed to a crawl in the open water fear as her veins thinned. Breathless. The storage room door was still open. Someone was coming. Should she shut it? Reach back to touch the cold metal door. It was so heavy she couldn't push it fast enough. How late was it, and who could it be? Out here where it was nowhere. If she shut it, would she be able to get out? The heavy old door? What if it locked like that, and no one knew or ever came, and there she was, shut in? If she shut it, wouldn't they still be able to get in? Would she be able to lock it in time? Everyone was always stronger. That was one thing she'd always learned. Terror pressed its fish-hook tips through her heart, and no breathing now. A figure already gliding through the doorway, in the room with her, silver gleaming glasses. A strange old-fashioned hat dropping a black velvet shadow over his face. A suit, a gentleman, a frightening gentleman. "I'm afraid we can't allow you in, madam." A voice, a bad voice. "Who's that?" she called. The shadows in the room reaching up over his hands, blending into the rich charcoal of his suit. Her throat retched and she tasted the bitter old rind of the inside taste. Like flowers, like grass ground up, like the earth inside out. He stepped toward her, the light gathering into two golden boils on the glassy edges of his spectacles.
"The entire facility is currently under watch," he said.
There was a tight, awful accent on the voice, deep and angular, as though the end of each word was a sword, neatly and with a flourish tucked into the scabbard of a grim silence. "Under watch," but she could not say the words. Her mouth hung dry with fear. She wanted to run, but her legs were fastened. Her bones were locked in sleep. This was a good example of something not good, she thought.
"Under surveillance, yes," the man continued. "I'm afraid I can't say why. My name is Mr. Grave, and I would like you to come with me. I would like to ask you some questions." "What an awful thing to say. What an awful thing to say." Edna could think of nothing else. Her voice crawled out of her like a man dying of thirst in the desert. "Tea in the guardhouse," Mr. Grave said. "We have a little television going. I do have questions." He removed his glasses, and it was his eyes now reflecting a strange mercury silver. Edna stared at them, searching for some campfire sign of her future, of her safety. But those eyes said, "No, you are not safe. These eyes want you to know that you are not safe, and not being safe is the last feeling you'll have." He held her in the stare until it seemed a small star exploded in each of his eyes. A sweeping white ink spilled over my vision, a white, blinding expulsion. I was pushed from Edna's presence. Had Mr. Grave done this? Or was it Edna's fear? Had her terror barred me? Or had he? The storage room faded into the white. The man in the hat and the mercury eyes faded. Edna faded. I felt the wind burning over my arms like sharp sleet in a waterfall. A view of the city far below, and the sharp currents of air, and a fluttering of snow. Was it snowing? Was it that cold? The moon was low and heavy above distant clouds. We were soaring, and then cutting hard back, and coming down toward the black Styx, my feet taking hold of the branch of a high tree. Catching my breath, the bird catching its breath, shuffling to a side, then standing in the perfect ease of the high reach of the long branch, settling and arranging toward stillness. Despite this, in the background, I could hear the muffled conversation continuing between Edna and Mr. Grave.
And our love should fade away.
I could not see them, and I was no longer there, but I could hear. Did Mr. Grave know I could still hear? What prompted you to return? He asked. Did someone ask you to come? Have you been approached?
We pay a yearly fee, Edna gasped.
I understand. What are you here to recover? What were you told to retrieve? Can you give me a description?
My radio,
Edna finally whispered.
I came for my radio. My other one broke.
Broke, Mr. Graves said.
A bird at the windowsill broke it, knocked it down onto the street. My radio at the window for years, for just years.
A bird, Mr. Graves said. What kind of bird? This is what he wanted most of all.
Why don't you come with me? Was it a pigeon? A starling? We'll have tea. Your husband used to be a silker. Do you remember that word? What an excellent fellow. I knew him, did you know?
You knew Albert, Edna said.
Edna hadn't heard the word silker in years, and even when Albert had told her, it was whispers under the covers in bed in the dark, late at night. His face on the pillow, his reddish hair combed back, leaning toward her under the drape of their blankets, the clean sheets of violet and vanilla, all the comforts of home, blue and red flowers in the vase on the great table, and their whispers locked away in the privacy of their bed.
He used to go off to the meetings with the Berg and the Billen.
Edna could not remember the name. The Bilderbergs. Yes, he and I would be brothers. I am a silker too. I still go to such meetings. If your husband were still alive, I'm sure we would have tea together. You still room at the William Pines, I don't wonder. A cold hand urged her from the storage room.
The William Pines, Edna said.
Yes.
What floor was it?
Fifth. Edna heard her breath stumbling into the sound of the number.
Fifth floor. Wonderful. And what sort of bird was it, this naughty bird?
Edna walked along the path. The snow was falling over her coat, but she did not notice it. Her skin was tight with anesthetic, as though she had fallen through a hole in the ice and was laying at the bottom in a thick black deposit of water, covered in the terror of the certainty of no getting away from this. That was what the fear was, and that was what was filling her now. The anesthetic that the body made and injected into itself when it knew for certain that bad things were coming to the moment. Snow fell on the huge silver-black bunkers in the distance, one after the other, like a military compound, and in the shadows before each one, figures standing to attention, like soldiers.
What sort of bird,
Edna? Mr. Grave whispered.
Pigeon? Starling? Sparrow? Do you see those men? Those men have guns. They take old women out into the woods. And do you know what happens then?
Edna could not speak.
What sort of bird, my dear?
She fell against him, terrorized and numb. If only her gloves in Albert's hat, her old spare hands against his face.
What sort of bird?
Mr. Grave asked for a last time. She was looking up into his face, the deep, troubled crisscross puzzle of his face. The twist and torment of the beehive skin, a small razor mustache, the mercury eyes, each with a floating tiny star. All her energy left, the only last final hope.
Please, please, please. It was a blackbird,
she whispered.
That's not me. I go where I please. I walk through. I'm not here. I'm not here. In a little while.
We stood in the cold branches, looking down over the city, the blackbird and I. A light chit-chat of snow falling here and there. Old men with soft faces, clean-shaven, browsing on the benches below, gesturing with mittens the old stories of what happened, and where, and who was there, and what was done last before the next time. Scarves around their stiff necks and soup in their bellies. Warm except at the business sock ankles. We are businessmen. We were industrious. We were citizens. We participated fully and were of use and we did well. And here we are still, waiting now for what happens next. The sky above unraveled its warship clouds, laying smoke down over the glossy moon. And then I was back, sitting at the window chair, having tea. I needed a moment to consider,
My concentration was of the birds when I was with the bird. Why did Mr. Grave want to know what sort of bird? I could not consider this deeply unless I was here, in the chair by the window, in my own body, with the tea. My body felt heavy, and I could not lift my arm. I raised the question, why did Mr. Grave want to know what sort of bird? And I let my mind begin to operate on it. I did not need to be there to direct the solution, and I returned with the breath back to the high perch in the tree, into the experience of the bird. We shifted along the branch, the blackbird and I, waiting. We were equally with each other, the bird and I. As much as I was here with him on the branch, he was there with me on the chair. I was helping him do this, and he was helping me consider the question. Why did Mr. Grave want to know what sort of bird? We were not simply passengers in the conveyance of each other's flesh, and not simply pilots. There was some unspoken mutuality beyond words or control or lines of separation. I could not physically divide myself from the idea of the bird. We were co-absorbed into a single experience, and yet there was a secondary local awareness, as the body might sense itself as a whole, but then again, also in its parts. A leg, an arm, a hand. One thing, but with a sense of its components. I returned to the window chair and felt the answer. There was no answer. We did not know why Mr. Grave wanted to know about what sort of bird. And what came of the question was a new instruction. Edna was in danger, and that was the only thing that could be known now. I returned to the blackbird. I pictured Edna's house on the lake. Go here, I suggested, into the soundless space of the bird, to the old fallen-down house near Lake Regent, out to the edge of the Bristol Forest. We know that land. We know those trees. The bird dropped from the branch, its wings sharpening to speed, feathers humming and huffing in the fast wind. We rose in the snowstorm and then settled our path just above the treetops, where a warm slick of humidity lay, like a moist blanket on the earth. The Bristol Forest was a cluttery wood, a confusion of old forest and new, as though a new city were being constructed inside the carapace of the old. Massive dying oaks and elms gave way to vibrant young pines and struggling birches. It was a forest folding over, breaking through its own death with a new formation, going from hard and strong to soft and supple. The treetops bustled with snow, like insects working furiously the soft mound of a flower. Lake Regent glistened its rough diamond in the distance below the dark knob of a hill in the milk shadows of the moon. A slurry single-lane road was then beneath us, and the bird used it for a mile or so, and then banked left up an overgrown gravel drive and past a fallen-down house, grey and shrunken on its shoulders, before rising a bit and slowing against the wind as the Bristol storage facility appeared. Edna was in the distance, slouching against Mr. Grave in her shocked semi-consciousness. He was propping her now, slapping her face lightly to revive her. She was standing weakly on dead legs, and he was propping her up and signaling for some of the guards to come and help him. Beyond this, hidden within the surrounding Bristol Forest, was a fortification of some kind, a compound with barrack-like buildings in six rows. We landed off into the trees and watched. There were six men, aside from Mr. Grave. Two guards held Edna under the arms while Mr. Grave issued orders to two men in suits. I urged the bird to move in closer. We swept low along the forest line and rose up and landed finally in the snow on one of the gambrel roofs of the barracks. We were closer now, but not close enough to hear. A car pulled forward and the two men in suits got in and hastened away, back toward the city, on a mysterious, sudden errand. Mr. Grave nodded to the two guards holding Edna, and the larger one took her up into his arms, and began walking alone down the broad corridor between the storage facility and the bunkers, moving toward the blackness of the woods. There were three men now standing before Mr. Grave, guards of some kind, or soldiers. They were standing oddly quiet, neither talking nor moving. The guard on the furthest right was slowly raising one arm. Mr. Grave, too, in a kind of slow motion, was drawing his hands up toward his ears. We were standing in the snow on the bunker top, the bird and I. Mr. Grave's hands were over his ears. The guard with the slow-moving arm was now still, taking aim. The sound of the gunshot immediately ejected me from the bird. I felt the close inspection of the bullet as it hummed past, sizzling in the air, boiling in the air nearby. But I was in the window chair again, a light sweat breaking instantly from my chest. I settled myself and opened up into the bird, but as with Edna before, I could not see, only hear. The guards running toward the bunker and Mr. Grave yelling out an order, and a few more rounds dispatched as the soldiers came running. "Have you flown away to safety, bird?" I wondered. "Or are you lying in the snow?" As Edna lays in the soldier's arms, too fragile for the world's dark moments. I opened myself to Edna and listened to the mean crunch of boots in snow marching through the forest. The bird was paralyzed on the snow of the bunker roof, and the men were coming. Edna was unconscious in the arms of the guard in the snowy forest, and there was a knocking somewhere, in the distance, behind me somewhere, as of a hand on wood. "Mr. Sleeves," a voice. Whose voice? I shook away, sitting once again in the window chair, a cold cup of tea in my hands. It was Mr. Bowman, the manager of the William Pines rooming house. "Mr. Bowman," I said. My voice sounded far away, as though piped into a small speaker in another room. "You'll have to come with me, sir," Mr. Bowman said. "With you?" I asked. "You have crossed the threshold. We didn't know it would be so soon, but they are coming for you now," Mr. Bowman said. "Who is?" I asked. "The Silka," Mr. Bowman said. "The Bilderberg Silka." "I don't know them," I said. "We can explain later," Mr. Bowman said. "I have been given the great honor of being assigned to you, sir." "I see," I said. I began to work my energy toward getting up. "Give me a hand, will you, Mr. Bowman?" "I'm afraid you'll have to leave it behind, sir," Mr. Bowman said. "Leave what behind?" I said. Hearing something, Mr. Bowman raced quickly to my window. He glanced down into the snowy darkness. "They're here now, sir," he said. "I've been assigned to you. It's perfectly fine." "Leave what behind?" I repeated. "Your body," Mr. Bowman said. "But I am open to you, as I said. I urge you to join me now. They are coming, sir." "I have been assigned." Mr. Bowman darted back to the door. He opened it. "Come with me now, sir." "Are you a stalwart, Mr. Bowman?" I asked. "They are inside the building and coming up the stairs. Now is the time, sir." His eyes, his heart, went begging across the room for me. I closed my eyes and fell from my body. For a moment, I was in the cold forest, hearing the snow crunching under the black boots of the bad soldier as he came to a stop and set Edna down in the snow. She was leaned against a cold tree, and her hands went dead alongside her. There followed the whispering sound of his leather holster as he took out his weapon. For a moment, I was the blackbird on the bunker roof, paralyzed with the shock of the explosive charge from the gun, laying tipped over in the inch or so of snow as the voices gathered around me. And then, suddenly, it was the dark, dusty halls of the William Pines rooming house, backing out slow and quiet in the shadows with Mr. Bowman, turning and creeping down into a corner, as two men in suits rose in the shadow up the far stairs, stepping up to my door, entering my apartment, guns raised, without a pause, as though every day it was the same. The sound of gunshots, and an end of feeling somewhere, of termination. The two men left, not in the room 10 seconds. Was this how the body ended? I was inside Mr. Bowman, and we were quickly down the stairs and out into the back alleys. Mr. Bowman's legs traced into a run.
vigorous, strong. He was an older man, but he did not run like one. Running now down Windsor, then to 4th Street, direct through Gresham Park. "We are fast," I whispered into the space. "We are very fast," Mr. Bowman whispered back. "How fast?" I wondered. Through the Gresham Park and then to the edge of the city, and then running out over the snowy, slushy single-lane road that the Blackbird and I had flown above earlier. Where were we heading, and how fast? "We're going for Edna," Mr. Bowman said. "We're going for the Blackbird, and this is how fast we're going." The wind exploded over Bowman's face and chest. We were instantly plastered and iced over with snow. But beyond that, in the perfect focus of the universe, not needing to see, not minding the soaking, melting, freezing ice on our body, not needing anything, just rushing at the fullest speed any flesh could bear to stand, our legs in an invisible torque, a blur of pistons pumping, as my body died in the window chair and the blood went dripping to the floor, as two guns were raised towards two sleeping faces, one in the woods, one on the roof, we ran, Bowman and I, as fast as flesh could go.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void.